Hi, this is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and welcome to this week's weekly podcast. This week, our feature text is Luke 16, 22 through 23, where it says, "The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was being tormented, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side." This week, I want to share a few thoughts on a topic that I have found almost impossible to get people to see until it finally just clicks for them. And I believe it offers a path towards doctrinal unity, and that's for those who think that that's a priority. Doctrinal unity in the midst of a very real and, for some, a very frustrating doctrinal ambiguity that they find out there. Now, first, doctrine is defined as a belief or set of beliefs held and taught by a church, a political party, or other group. And what I want to help us see this week is that there are really two types of doctrine. My hope is that we can rally around one type or one kind of doctrine while tolerating and even embracing the ambiguity that exists with the other type or other kind of doctrine. And let me use the above story by Jesus that we just read in Luke 16 to illustrate what I mean by all this. The best way to see what I'm talking about this week is to ask, what was Jesus' purpose in telling the story of the rich man and Lazarus? What we do know is that the story was not a historical retelling of two actual persons, but rather it was a folk tale that had been told and retold within many cultures of that day. This is from Jeremiah's book, Parables, page 183. In order to understand the parable in detail and as a whole, it is essential to recognize the first part derives from a well-known folk material. This is the Egyptian folk tale of the journey of Osiris to the underworld. Alexandrian Jews brought this story to Palestine, where it became very popular as the story of the poor scholar and the rich publican Bar Majan. And now, numerous versions of this story are found in the ancient world, including this version told by Jesus. So what was Jesus' purpose in telling, or rather retelling, this story? Was it to give a detailed exposition of the doctrine of what takes place in the afterlife? Was it given to tell us for sure what happens when a person dies? And for me personally, as one who rejects the doctrine of eternal torment, and I've openly rejected that for about 20 years now, I find it curious that the context of Jesus's retelling of this folktale was not in response to someone asking him the question, what happens when a person dies? It was in response to being ridiculed by those who belong to a political party called the Pharisees, who Luke tells us were lovers of money. And this was in response to Jesus' teachings on economics and money. In Luke 16:14, this is the context of the rich man and Lazarus. It says, "The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all this, and they ridiculed him." So Jesus uses this story that would have been common to them to communicate an ethical truth, an ethical doctrine, which may or not be true ontologically. In other words, the ethical treatment of the poor was a higher priority value here to Jesus than strict adherence to the truest picture of what really happens in the afterlife. You have two types of truth here. You have ethical truth and you have ontological truth. Now, ontology, in its simplest explanation, and I'm sure there are better definitions out there, but it's basically the study of the kind of things that exist. In other words, does hell exist? What is the afterlife like? And other things, but it's the study of what kind of things exist. Is there a God or not? Jesus met these Pharisees where they were at ontologically. He didn't argue over what happens when a person dies. The Pharisees believed in the eternal torment of wicked souls. Josephus backs this up in The War of the Jews, Volume 2, Chapter 8, Paragraph 14. And even at the risk of appearing to condone the Pharisees' ontology, he uses this story to teach them a much more ethical truth. And ethics are defined as basically the moral principles that govern a person or a group's behavior, how we treat one another. Some have endeavored to distinguish the difference, and in reality, the lines are really blurred. It's hard to distinguish the difference between these two, but some have tried to distinguish these two types of truth, these two types of doctrine, with the terms orthodoxy and orthopraxy. And I don't think those terms are perfect, but they'll work sort of for what we're going to be talking about this week. Orthodoxy is related to beliefs about how we should think about things, whether or not hell exists, what do we think it'll be like. That's the one example we're looking at here in Luke 16. Orthopraxy is related to belief about how we should live. It defines matters of practice, orthopraxy, or matters of conduct. And to be fair, Jesus' story of the rich man Lazarus, in my opinion, is a story that is rich in establishing the orthopraxy of a Jewish follower with regard to the poor, with total disregard by Jesus for how it may confuse the orthodoxy of a Jesus follower. And I'm sure those of you who embrace eternal torment out there listening this week, you're not necessarily seeing my distinction here. But for those of you who feel that the overarching evidence of the New Testament leads you to either be an annihilationist, where the wicked will be destroyed in the end, or it leads you to be a universalist, where you believe that all people will one day somehow be restored to Jesus, both of you can appreciate this distinction that I'm making. How many times have you wished that Jesus had not used the story of the rich man and Lazarus when you're trying to dialogue with someone who intensely embraced the doctrine of eternal torment? Remember, Judaism was largely a strongly orthopraxic religion. It had a poverty of theology concerning what the afterlife really looked like for a Jew, compared to what the Egyptians taught or what the Babylonians taught about the afterlife. They had intricate and ornate theologies about what happens when a person dies. The Hebrews had basically nothing. Judaism was mostly concerned with not what happens to a Jew when they died, but how a Jew was to live in the present life. Within Judaism, out of which Christianity was born, remember, you were unlikely to be criticized for thinking incorrectly, but you would most definitely be criticized for behaving incorrectly. In early Christianity, when one begins with the New Testament and reads all the way through the patristic writings, early Christianity emerges as a movement that, like Jesus, placed orthopraxy, doctrinal truth concerning how we are to live, above orthodoxy. And we're defining that this week as doctrinal truth about how we are to think about things. Now that's not to say that orthodoxy was not important to them. Again, it's not a matter of all or nothing. Both orthodoxy and orthopraxy have their value and their importance. But if we have to choose between uniting around orthopraxy versus uniting around orthodoxy, early Christianity was very clear on orthopraxy. They were uniting around that, while it possessed varying degrees of ambiguity surrounding some of the issues regarding orthodoxy. Let me give you an example. This is from the New Chef and Herzog, page 96, paragraph 3. In the first 5 or 6 centuries of Christianity, there were 6 known theological schools, of which 4, Alexandria, Antioch, Caesarea, and Edessa, were universalist. 1, Ephesus, accepted conditional immortality. 1, being in Carthage or Rome, taught endless punishment of the wicked. Now, what you have is 3 views existing here in the early church regarding a matter of orthodoxy as far as what's going to happen to those who don't receive Jesus in this life. Some believed, 4 believed that somehow everyone was going to be restored. 1 taught that conditional immortality, they would cease to be exist, they would just be annihilated, and the other one taught eternal torment. And even within the first 3 centuries of Christianity, you see well-respected church fathers disagreeing on this topic. You can find this in the same book on page 96, paragraph 2. For the first 300 years of Christianity, what every church follower of Jesus did unite around, what every church father did agree on without one dissenting voice or disagreement, was the doctrine of nonviolence, the doctrines of helping the poor, the doctrine of enemy love, the doctrine of the golden rule, doing unto others what you would have them do to you. These were the doctrines that the church all agreed on and which united them. They were able to unite around doctrinal truths in the areas of orthopraxy while tolerating differences, and differences that would be unthinkable in Western Protestantism today regarding doctrinal truths in the areas of orthodoxy. Again, the lines aren't always clear, and some matters of orthodoxy parade as matters of orthopraxy and the other way around also. Sometimes it's not always easy to see the difference between the two. And this week we're kind of giving an oversimplified view of the two, but an oversimplified place to begin is simply to ask, how does this subject affect the way that I treat others? And if the subject's connection to our treatment of one another is either missing or it's convoluted, it's complex, it's hard to see, it's indirect, most of the time it's a matter of orthodoxy. In all fairness, it's about balance. True orthodoxy should always support and encourage and be in harmony, and not contradict, but be in harmony with true orthopraxy. But remember, orthopraxy, it's orthopraxy that should govern orthodoxy, not the other way around. But we'll get to that in the teachings of Jesus in just a moment. Today we find ontological arguments again abounding everywhere surrounding topics such as hell, the Trinity, end time events or eschatology, what happens when a person dies, the mystery of the incarnation, atonement theories. The list could go on and on and on. And while matters of orthopraxy, if you stop and look, the manner in which we're treating one another over these issues is being entirely ignored or worse. Many times, Jesus' strict teachings on orthopraxy, how we relate to one another, are being defiantly disobeyed in the name of defending what we consider to be correct orthodoxy. Now it is true that there were matters of orthodoxy that were deemed heretical within the first three centuries of Christianity, but to the largest degree, Christianity did not become a creedal religion until the era surrounding the Constantinian shift. Remember, this was a time when the ethical teachings of Jesus either became abandoned or at best marginalized by a church that now favored unity being defined by and based on what people thought about things. It became about doctrines of ontology, like the Apostles' Creed, about story details rather than ethical teachings. It became an ontologically weighted religion rather than a radically different ethically based movement that we see in the first century. Jesus gave us a way to heal the world, and this way in the early church, was the primitive church, was centered in the way of love. This way was largely abandoned with the union of the empire with the church in the fourth century. The early church was defined as the way to live in relation to others. The church that arose out of the Constantinian shift became associated with, instead, the way to think about certain topics or you'll be burned at the stake. The doctrinal beliefs concerning certain ethics were significantly marginalized in favor of discussions around the doctrinal beliefs that concern ontological realities. In Paul's letter to the Galatians, he eloquently wrote, this is Galatians 5:22-23, "By contrast, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control." The fruit of the Spirit, we have to notice, are all ethical differences that are made in a person's life. They're not necessarily ontological, the way we think about things. The Spirit, while giving some measure of priority to doctrines of thought, it doesn't seem to give them anywhere near the same priority as doctrines of being or doctrines of living. And some will say, But correct orthodoxy is important. It's worth fighting for because it's what produces orthopraxy. In other words, orthopraxy is born out of orthodoxy. And what we believe about things leads to and affects how we treat others. And as much as I used to believe this and would love to believe this again, here are two realities that this kind of thinking ignores. First, in my last 20 years of following Jesus, I have met loads of people who have what is considered by many to be right thinking about certain topics, but in reality, they are just downright mean people. They're unkind, they're right intellectually, but they're dead wrong when it comes to the fruit of the Spirit. They have what is considered by many to be doctrinal truth in regards to what they believe about certain topics, but they are absolute heretics when it comes to the doctrinal truth of how they are to relate to others. If right thinking always leads to right living, one has to wonder how long that process is going to take for these folks. And it didn't seem to take quite as long for folks in the book of Acts. And the second point tells us why the book of Acts reveals a different experience for the early church. And quite frankly, it's Jesus. And this is my second and biggest objection to placing orthodoxy above orthopraxy. Within the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus did not do much ontological correction in regard to how people thought about things, like we saw with the rich man and Lazarus. Instead, Jesus spent the majority of his teaching on matters of ethics, how we're to relate to others. Jesus didn't explain the nature of the Trinity in the Sermon on the Mount, the mystery of his incarnation. He didn't talk about what happens to a person post-mortem. He didn't cover any of these topics. He was basically saying, if you want to be my follower, he wasn't saying believe these certain things. He was saying, if you want to be my follower, this is how you live. This is how you follow my teachings. What Jesus did teach was enemy love, joy in the midst of persecution, the way of peace or nonviolence, patience with the way of a mustard seed, kindness toward the ungrateful and the unthankful, generosity toward those being marginalized on the basis of being religiously judged as living contrary to the Torah, faithfulness to the sacredness of every person, gentleness towards everyone's oppressors, and self-control when one wants to retaliate. And if you cross-reference that with Galatians 5:22-23, that is the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. And this is where orthodoxy and orthopraxy actually unite for Jesus. For Jesus, his orthopraxy was his orthodoxy. But what about those other things? Aren't they important? And I want to be very clear this week, of course they're important. But what Jesus reveals is that correct orthopraxy does not necessarily flow out of correct orthodoxy. In reality, Jesus taught the exact opposite. If you will follow Jesus' teachings on orthopraxy, it will challenge, it will influence, and ultimately it'll radically change a person's orthodoxy. Jesus asks us to live a certain way, whether that makes sense with what we believe about God, ourselves, or others, or not. And the magic is that once one embraces how Jesus taught us to live, it challenges and corrects any mistakes we might be holding on to regarding how we see God, how we see ourselves, and how we see others. Just one example, if the Jews of Jesus' day had embraced how Jesus was saying they should relate to the Romans, that itself, in itself, would have demanded a radical change in what they were presently believing about God's character, about who they were in relation to others, and who others were in relation to themselves. My wife, Crystal, often jokingly points out that I inadvertently always choose the path of most resistance. Whatever the most difficult path is, she says, I'll take it. And the path of trying to figure out ontological truth in hopes of one day arriving at ethical truth, practicing ethical truth, is a hard, it is an uncertain, and it's an unguaranteed path. And I've discovered this from experience. That was my path for years. But when I saw what Jesus was actually teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, and how radically different it was from my present religious experience, having embraced his teachings there, embracing his teachings there radically influenced, and in some areas it radically changed what I believed at that point about almost every other ontological doctrine that I had held in my headspace. The path of following the ethical teachings of Jesus, uniting on the doctrine of the golden rule, the doctrine of nonviolent enemy love, the doctrine of generosity to those we used to deem as morally inferior to ourselves, the doctrine of helping the poor. These are the doctrines within the Sermon on the Mount. To unite on these doctrines, giving these doctrines priority, these are the doctrines that should unite us. These are the type of doctrines that influence what we believe about most everything else. Should we have doctrinal unity? Absolutely we should. But let the doctrines that we unite on be the doctrines that Jesus actually taught, while allowing each person to be in process, wading through the ambiguity that exists on doctrines that Jesus chose not to expound on. And this is how I believe we can experience doctrinal unity around certain kinds of doctrine, even amidst what at times are very significant amounts of ambiguity surrounding other kinds of doctrine. In the end, remember, we won't be given a test on our ontology. We'll be asked how we treated the least of these. And you can find that in Matthew 25:31-45. Jesus' last words to his disciples in the Gospel of Matthew were, "Go and make disciples, teaching them to obey everything that I've commanded." Because in the obeying of the commands that Jesus clearly gave, it changes how we see God, how we see ourselves, how we see everyone else. It demands a change. If we're going to relate to others the way Jesus taught us to, it changes everything else we believe. Heart group application this week. In the famous C.S. Lewis book, The Last Battle, Aslan meets a Kalorman named Emeth. And Emeth has lived his life in service to Tash, the false god of the Kalorman. And yet the spirit in which the servant Emeth, served Tash was so radically different from the character of Tash, and much more in harmony with the spirit of Aslan, that Aslan actually says here in his dialogue with Emeth, he says, "I take to me the services which thou hast done to Tash, for I and he are of such different kinds that no service which is vile can be done to me, and none which is not vile can be done to him." The point that Lewis is trying to make here is clear. It's the same point Jesus tried to make in Matthew 7, that we can even cast out demons in the name of Jesus, but one day still be unrecognizable to him. That's Matthew 7:21-23. And yet there are some things done in the spirit of love, even though they're in ignorance and not consciously knowing Jesus, that John states quite clearly in 1 John 4:7, those things could not be done unless we were responding on some level, knowingly or unknowingly, to God in our lives. And again, that's 1 John 4:7. The way of Jesus, it defies all of our exterior labels. We're all on a journey. We're all in process. And we must be exceedingly careful how we evaluate ourselves and others. The Pharisees looked at one single focal point in a person's life and judged whether someone was living in harmony with the Torah or whether they were not. And those who were not, they defined as a sinner. Jesus, on the other hand, looked at least three focal points. Jesus looked at where the person had been, where the person was right now in front of him, and he looked at himself. He would, and sometimes it was incomplete, he was completely ignoring the Torah. He would look simply at whether a person was moving within these three points, these three focal points, whether that person was moving toward himself or away from himself. And those who, regardless of where they were in their life at that moment, were moving toward him, he simply said with open arms, "Welcome to the kingdom." It is much more radically inclusive than many are comfortable with, and it'll scare some, but to others it will be a lighthouse on a turbulent seashore guiding them the rest of the way home. This week, I want you to spend some time with Jesus, sitting and contemplating with him three passages. The first one is Matthew 25:31-46. The second one is Matthew 7:21-23. And the last one is 1 John 4:7. And as you're meditating on these, sit there with Jesus. Ask him to expound upon these for you. And journal any thoughts that Jesus shares with you as the two of you just sit there and meditate on these passages and what they're saying. And lastly, whatever it is that Jesus teaches you this week, I want you to share it with your heart group this upcoming time that you're meeting together. Keep encouraging one another. Keep loving one another all the more as you see the day that Acts calls universal restoration approaching. Keep living in love till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. Look up Hebrews 10:24-25, Acts 3:21, and let's close with Jesus' great commission that I just mentioned a moment ago. Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything that I've commanded you, and remember, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. This is what the early church rallied around. This was the doctrine, the root of their doctrinal unity. Other doctrines they were in process on, but this is what centered them. It's what defined them. It's what gave them meaning. It's what caused them to be a radical movement that was in the process of putting the world right side up again. I love you guys. We'll see you next week.